Hello, and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy. We strive to relate, educate, and innovate, one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Our podcast explores topics that relationship-based therapists care about. In addition to featuring unique conversations and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
When was the last time you had a good laugh in session? Either poking fun at yourself or finding yourself smiling at a funny statement or mannerism that your clients made. Although humor is certainly something that's not taught in graduate school or explained much in supervision, there's actually a consistent literature on the many health and relational benefits of shared humor. Studies show that it elevates mood, reduces stress and anxiety, even obsessional thinking. Research on the specific benefits of therapy and humor conclude that increased trust deflates shame, improves clients' self-esteem, and opens the possibilities for new perspectives that helps clients get unstuck. It can truly be cathartic. So on this episode of the AAMFT podcast, I'm sitting down with Dr. Devin Usong to talk about integrating humor into your practice of systemic therapy. Let's talk about a lot of stuff, but Devin really focuses that when utilized appropriately, humor can strengthen an alliance, demonstrate a therapist's genuine positive feelings toward the client system, and therefore allowing the clients to open up and experience similar feelings in return. Devin Usong is a clinical psychologist and faculty member in the Doctor of Psychology program at Chestnut Hill College. His professional and research interests include the role of humor in psychotherapy, personality assessment, media ecology, and the psychology of religion. In addition to being a professor and trainer, he's part of a group practice where he provides assessment and psychotherapy services to teenagers and adults. This is our final episode of 2024, the end of the sixth season. And we're going to end it with a good laugh and a cut-in from the late, great George Carlin. We'll be back to wrap up the season after our interview with Devin. Devin, welcome to the AAMFT podcast. This is one that I am really looking forward to. I have read your article in Family Therapy Magazine a while back, and I'm like, this would be a great podcast. And we don't know each other, but I'm hopeful that our listeners will also like how we include humor in our work with client systems, specifically couples and families, but we'll talk about any type of client system, including individuals today. So traditionally on the podcast, we like to know about our experts' psychotherapy origin story, so to speak, and then specifically how you got interested in studying humor and psychotherapy.
Yeah. First of all, thanks so much for having me on, and I appreciate your interest in the topic. An ironic thing that everyone uses humor in their daily lives, and yet in the psychotherapy literature, there isn't a whole lot of research about its function in psychotherapy. Glad to have this conversation with you. And like you say, I hope it's a fun and meaningful conversation. Yeah, my psychotherapy origin story is maybe a little cliche. I grew up in a divorced family. At an early age, I was doing some co-parent counseling. It was not uncommon for, a drop off for my mother to say, tell your father next time, be 15 minutes early. And then I would go up to dad's car and say, hi, dad. Mom says hi. She says, cool haircut. And if you could just be 15 minutes early next time, that would be great. I think at an early age, I was falling into this role. But the nice thing about my parents is that they're both wonderful people. Mom is a nurse, a very compassionate caring person, and Dad is a coach, a wonderful orator. And I think when you mix those two things together, someone who is compassionate and has a love of conversation, you do tend to end up in a line of work like this. So that was my psychotherapy origin story, was just going through those experiences, getting positive benefits out of being in therapy as a young person, and being curious about things like this, humor, personality dynamics. That was a big part of the motivation, for sure. I could certainly say a little bit about my interest in humor and therapy, if that would be interesting to you.
Sure, it would.
Yeah, a couple things spring to mind. One, like I mentioned, there doesn't seem to be a tremendous amount of research about what therapists think about humor being used in therapy. There's a little bit here and there, but it's pretty disparate. But I'm thinking even of someone like Dr. Rod Martin, who wrote a textbook on the psychology of humor. I'm quoting him here. He says, "Research exploring the utility and efficacy of humor utilization in therapy is scarce and requires further study." That's coming from the head honcho. So that was appealing to me as a graduate student, to be able to make a contribution where there's really a need in terms of research. I tend to be attracted to things that maybe are a little taboo or controversial. And I think there's sometimes an aversion amongst clinicians to talk openly about their use of humor in therapy, maybe for fear that they'll be perceived as not taking their clients' struggles seriously, or that they might be behaving in a frivolous sort of way. But in my research, when I interviewed clinicians about their use of humor in therapy, all of them more or less said, yes, it's pretty much part and parcel of what I do, not in every session, but it's always there in the background for the most part. And that it's not contrived, it emerges organically during the course of the therapy relationship. So one other quick thought for you there. Probably the most immediate motivation would be the comedian George Carlin, who I fell in love with as a young person. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of George Carlin.
Very familiar. Yes. Why do I drive?
Yes.
In a parkway and park in a driveway. I actually saw George Carlin as a young man. I'm quite a bit older than you, I think, 47 years old. But one of my favorite memories with my parents growing up was going to see George Carlin, a show. Some of our other listeners may remember him, the seven words you can't say on television. And then he had a second life in the late 80s and 90s through his Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. But yeah, I'm a big George Carlin fan.
That warms my heart to know that we have that in common. Yeah, I wonder if like me, you also felt that his delivery feels like you're being addressed personally. And I know a lot of stand-up comedians try to achieve that. But with Carlin, it almost felt like you'd proctored a college lecture where the professor just happened to be very funny. And being obsessed, I started
listening. Yeah, because he was also smart. And I think he was both relatable, but his humor always appealed to me because they were very obvious observations of things that happen in real life, his ability to connect an audience. But I think George Carlin was very intelligent too. And I always liked the accessibility, yet the intelligence of his humor as well.
Yeah, no, that's certainly what attracted to me about him. In some ways, I think of his stand-up comedy as being very psychoanalytic. His material about when he's commenting on war, talking about how all the rockets and bombs are phallic symbols and this sort of thing. For a young man who's interested in psychology, this was sugar. I just couldn't get enough. But at one point, he made an appeal to the academic community. He basically was saying that there is an interesting relationship between anger and sadness and humor and laughter. In fact, if you don't mind, I'll just briefly quote him here. He says, "Crying and laughter are very closely related. They both produce tearing of the eyes, baring of the teeth, an involuntary expulsion of air. And it seems that pain and joy are very closely linked together with comedy and with humor." So he goes on to go through a whole list of all the different expressions that are used when people describe stand-up comedy. Things like gag, slapstick, punchline, "I killed them, I slaughtered them, I died out there." And he was curious about the idea that there might be some relationship between humor and people processing their anger, their discomfort, their depression. So he appealed to the academic community to take a look at that. And I thought as a grad student, I was egocentric enough to think, all right, I'll take up Carlin on that challenge and see if I can address some of those questions.
So before we go any further, let's give our listeners, maybe some that have never heard of the sardonic wit and comic genius that is George Carlin. Let's give a little taste. Here's George Carlin talking about self-help, a concept very familiar to our audience.
"I Now, something else a lot of you are aware of, those of you with illegal cable hookups will be aware of the fact that one of the things I like to do in my shows is complain, you know? It's kind of a motif for me, complaining. And, of course, this weird culture we live in leaves you no shortage of things to complain about. So this next piece of material, like most good ideas, is fairly simple. It's just a list of people who ought to be killed. Starting with these people who read self-help books. Why do so many people need help? Life is not that complicated. You get up, you go to work, you eat three meals, you take one good shit, and you go back to bed. What's the fucking mystery? And the part I really don't understand, if you're looking for self-help, why would you read a book written by somebody else? That's not self-help, that's help. There's no such thing as self-help. If you did it yourself, you didn't need help. You did it yourself. Try to pay attention to the language we've all agreed on.
Yes, so as you were doing your research as a graduate student, I think you said there's a dearth of that as it pertains to psychotherapy. But in general, as we get our discussion started today, what does the research tell us about the benefits, just in general, about humor, specifically humor between family members or romantic partners?
Yeah, it turns out there are many benefits associated with humor. For one thing, we know it's a nearly universal human experience. It's something that transcends culture. It even transcends time. There have been books written about humor in ancient Rome, and I think you and I would be hard-pressed to understand the punchline, but if you lived in that context, humor would be every bit a part of your daily life as it is now. Humor helps people around the world manage stress. It enriches their lives. It has the potential to strengthen relationships and increase hopefulness. These are all integral aspects of what we try to do as psychotherapists. And even smaller things that shouldn't be taken for granted. Humor makes boring tasks seem interesting. And sometimes being in therapy is a bit of a slog. So something that makes it more engaging and meaningful can be very helpful. To be a little more clinical about it, there's been research that shows that humor and laughter have the potential to counteract effects of depressed mood, symptoms of anxiety. It can build character strength, increase psychological well-being. That's Seligman's research. Even what is sometimes called non-Duquesne laughter, you can think of it as a kind of contrived laughter where a researcher says, I want you to laugh for 30 seconds. You're not laughing because you necessarily found anything funny, but you're just eliciting that response. Even that seems to have positive physiological benefits for people, increasing pain tolerance, reducing the experience of pain, all that kind of stuff. And I would just add that some of the research I've looked at also suggests that humor helps people expand their awareness about otherwise hidden thoughts or feelings. And in a way, what humor does is it forces you to recontextualize some of your ideas in a new frame. Because maybe we'll talk about it a little later, but if you think about what humor really is, it's when there's some incongruency that requires you to resolve the incongruency by recontextualizing what you've heard or what you've seen or experienced. So that's a lot of what we do in therapy, is helping people evaluate what's happened, come up with alternative conceptualizations, and recontextualize. There are many different theories of humor that have been advanced throughout the years. And it's one of those things where it's like that allegory of the blind men with the elephant. They're all touching a different part and they can't quite put together what this object is. I think virtually all of these theories have something to say about what humor is. I won't torture you with all of them. Freud, for example, thought humor was a way of satisfying unconscious desires, and it was a kind of compromise between maybe what was going on in terms of your drives and the realities of the life. But he saw it as a very high-level defense mechanism. So his framing is that humor serves a defensive purpose, but it's often a benevolent one. It suggests that a person can be sympathetic towards others. It might be a benevolent form of amusement. He separates things like wit from humor and talks about how one can be aggressive and the other is more to calm yourself down. But that's just one view. The ancient philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, they thought that humor was about superiority, that it's a lot to do with laughing about the misfortunes of others, almost in a Schadenfreude sort of sense, deriving pleasure from other people's misfortune. There have been relief theories. One that I'm fond of is sometimes called benign violation theory. It's the idea that for something to be perceived as funny, there has to be some form of a violation that occurs. Maybe it was a surprise, or maybe something you held as a sacred cow has been lampooned. And whether or not the person will derive humor from that thing is whether or not the threat is perceived as benign or dangerous to them in some way. So these are all different theories that try to explain why maybe client A finds something funny that you said, and client B might hear the exact same thing and take exception to it and not understand or care to laugh. So those are just some of the theories that maybe have explanatory power for why we see the diversity of humor expression that we do with our clients.
I love studying the therapeutic alliance, and I think humor is a sign of a strong therapeutic alliance in the sense you don't have to be as buttoned up or the client is comfortable joking with you. So how do you think humor is related to a therapeutic alliance?
Yeah, I think it's often integral. Not always. There are times where, you know, what the client brings into therapy is so heavy or profound that it's not even that humor isn't appropriate, but the time isn't right. Yeah, I'm sure you've heard that expression, the right intervention at the wrong time is the wrong intervention. And humor can be like that. It's often the case that as a therapist, you'll find something funny, but you're not sure that the client is either ready or prepared or capable of seeing what you... And at the same time, humor brings people together. I imagine your listeners can relate to the idea that if someone says something that you find funny, it's very similar to when someone says they love a song that you love. There's just this tacit understanding that the two of you now share, and it brings you together. There's an indelible stamp there. Now I know without having to say that we have a similar perception. I think that unites people. And even as a graduate student, I always thought the way sometimes people talk about the therapeutic alliance feels very contrived. Like sometimes in the textbook, it'll say you should be respectful and be caring and interested in them. And I think that's the way I feel about the people at the grocery store. I don't want them to be hurt. I hold the door open for them. Like you allude to, a therapy relationship is something so much deeper. It's about cultivating a sense of shared understanding, shared connection, really seeing the other person, not just their external appearance, but what's going on under the hood. And I think humor is one of multiple ways that you can achieve that. I could drone on and on, but I think it has real value for that purpose.
In my own experience, when I feel like I can be my real self and I have a strong alliance with someone, there is safety built up, that usually over time, that part of me will come out. It doesn't come out on an initial session, but it is a product of over time. So when I think of this, I think of kind of two ways where you either flow off your client's humor. So they bring things up, they're either witty or funny, and you generally find that amusing and you go off of that, or you inject your own wit and humor into the session. And certainly they work together, I think, because I think in most sessions where I have therapeutic relationships with different systems, whether it be individual, couple, or family, I think if I'm being relaxed and being funny that way, I am usually getting reinforced by the other side, meaning they are also going back and forth that way, or it becomes a part of the rapport building, or there are certain callbacks, so to speak. I think part of my humor is picking up on things that the client says and bringing it back as a theme. And I have one of the strengths that I have is a decent memory. So sometimes if I can remember something a client said early in a session, later on, it becomes a theme that can be a humorous callback. So what are your thoughts on responding to the client's humor versus injecting your own?
Sure. Yeah. And I should say, just on the tail end of what you were saying, I love that idea that using memory to make the experience more cohesive by a call back to something that was funny a few sessions ago. That all provides a kind of frame for the therapy experience that can be very helpful for clients. In terms of like flowing off their humor versus injecting your own, I think that both can be valid and there's a time for both, but flowing off the client's humor, I think is generally safer. One has to be careful not to collude with problematic impulses like avoidance. If you're going to inject your own wit and humor into a session, I think it's always important to have a clinical rationale for why you're doing that. Because ultimately, the humor should serve the purpose of facilitating some type of collaborative playfulness or something like that. There should be some agenda in mind. I think sometimes psychoanalysts might be perceived as being sticks in the mud about this sort of thing, but maybe some of that is fair, but I do think there is an attention paid to whether or not the therapist is using the humor for their own gratification, as opposed to having some working idea about how this might facilitate some new way of thinking or feeling for the client. But like I say, I think both can be valid. I think the usefulness of humor is always contingent upon contextual factors. So I'm thinking of things like, what is the symptomatic presentation of the client? I'm considering things like their gender, the culture they come from, all that stuff, race, ethnicity, religion, sex. Class is another one. Humor tends to be different along class lines. And maybe the one that's most dear to my heart, only because as a professor in a psychoanalytic program, I get to talk about personality dynamics a lot. I think that plays a big role in it. So just to give you an example, if a client is going to lead the humor and they say something self-deprecating, and I know that their personality is organized around themes of guilt and shame, I am probably going to be much more apprehensive about laughing at their joke. Not because the joke isn't funny, but because I worry about colluding with the assumption that there's something defective about the person. I wouldn't want to validate that automatic thought or that erroneous assumption. Whereas if I'm working with a client who is organized around egotistical or narcissistic themes, and they make a self-deprecating joke with a tempered kind of enthusiasm, I might want to champion that and really validate. It's okay to laugh at yourself. That's actually a pretty normative behavior that we want to encourage. Yeah, I think a lot of this depends on who the person is, what contextual factors they bring to the therapeutic encounter.
Yeah, you're talking now about assessing. So just to flow off of that, if a client is using humor as a way to mask what they are there, the work to do, and it's successful, and then it gets a reaction and it shifts. So is the humor meant to distract, or is it meant to further beat themselves up? Even if it's funny, as you said, you would not want to collude in anything that could potentially play into the client's negative view of themselves or their relationship. But there are also times in assessment where humor can be a real strength. I was working with this one young guy, and he is very funny, but he is self-conscious about his physical appearance and stops him from dating and doing other things. But people had told him he's funny, but he has a hard time embracing that. But I think hearing it from different sources, including the therapist, so assessing, is the humor a strength of the person, or is it used as a distraction or a detriment, is one takeaway from our talks right now. And then this idea of being self-deprecating on the therapist. I guess what I have learned is the way to test out, especially, and I've learned this as we're both training therapists as well, I think being self-deprecating and being able to poke fun at yourself is a safe way for many therapists or trainers or professors, supervisors, to wade into this material versus starting with a playful joke about a client or about a student. What are your thoughts in your own style of being self-deprecating as a way to test out the waters of integrating humor into your clinical work?
Yeah, I think there's two things there. I appreciate you mentioning the assessment aspect of this. That was one of the most intriguing findings of my dissertation research, was that not only is humor potentially helpful clinically as a tool, but it also can be diagnostic, because certain types of clinical presentations tend to come attached to certain styles of humor. We're talking about people who might be organized around themes of anxiety or depression, and they might use more self-deprecating humor. People who are more prone to act out or might have more disorganized kind of personality dynamics, they might use more extravagant, aggressive types of humor. And it can guide not only what you do clinically, but it can also guide the conceptualization of who this person is that you're working with, what their internal life is like, what system they come from, and whose humor is this? Is this your sense of humor? Is this your family's sense of humor? Can you tell the distinction between you and the other? So that's one aspect of it. But in terms of being self-deprecating, I think as long as you're not colluding with avoidance or an enactment or something like that, I think, like you say, it can demonstrate a certain kind of humility. It can make you seem more inviting, more relatable. I think also at times it might model effective coping skills. I'm thinking about, there have been times in session where I spilled coffee on myself, and rather than having an angry outburst, I might just say something like, okay, we'll be doing wet therapy today. Sorry about that. And it's small, but you're modeling for the client that it's okay to laugh at yourself. It's okay to have an elastic response to life's stresses, those sorts of things.
Another option I was thinking about as you were talking, that sometimes I would use, if I don't want to make it about me or be self-deprecating, or if I don't want to make a funny observation about the client or system I have in front of me, I may tell a humorous therapy story that has, in my 24 years of doing this, that I have encountered, that is humorous, but also teaches a lesson about something about, oh, in my case, couple communication or family dynamics or dealing with a challenging loved one. So it is not directly about the client or about me, but it is a funny quip that clearly has a takeaway. What is your thought about using some type of disquisition or story like that?
I find, like you, I do that same thing from time to time. And I like to think I always have a rationale, but I don't. Sometimes the impulse just comes over me and I think maybe this will make me more relatable. Or I work with a lot of young adults, and I think sometimes that's a way to expedite the feeling of relatedness when there's something like a 20-year age difference between us. I think it can humanize the therapist. But I'm also thinking about times where, you know, I took a stab at that and it did not go well. And then there's other times where I think it was really effective. And it's very hard to know in advance when something's going to land. Yeah, it's amazing how sometimes the same humorous thing will land very differently with two different clients.
Spent a lot of my formative years as a systemic therapist in Chicago. Chicago is known for second city improv. And I often thought, I never did this, I often thought if I had an extended sabbatical or break, I would take an improv class, because there's a lot of what we do as therapists is, again, adapting, thinking on the fly, not being so scripted or manualized. So improv helps with that and helps with humor. I also thought of, which is something I'm more likely to do, is take a storytelling class. Because as I said before, I think is storytelling, whether you are a therapist, a instructor, a supervisor, is so powerful. And learning to inject humor in your stories, as we just mentioned, it could be a powerful intervention. I guess I wonder what your, both in your research and your personal work outside, kind of inspirations or training could help you naturally, organically, this skill. Because I think if you're not funny, trying to be funny in a therapy setting is going to bomb miserably. But if you're a naturally funny person, being comfortable interjecting into therapy could work over time. And I think there's probably outside non-psychotherapy training that could help you do that. But I'm wondering, in your research and in your personal experience, if you think there's any other external things that could help develop more of a natural style of humor in your therapeutic way of being.
I think there are some people who are naturally, they just have the gift, and they might not be comedians or therapists. They might be, I don't know, bus drivers, or they might be construction workers or Wall Street brokers. And for whatever reason, they're just such funny people. And it wasn't necessarily that they were trained. It just seems to be a characteristic that they've either inherited or come by, honestly. So I think if you're the kind of person who doesn't naturally have that gift, that's okay. But like you say, I wouldn't force it. And I think you're absolutely right that if you try to introduce some contrived humor in a session, the client is going to look at you askance and wonder, what is going on here? Why does this person feel the need to construct some type of humor that isn't emerging? And the truth is, you don't have to be a stand-up comedian as a psychotherapist. There are going to be funny moments anyway. I think for most of us, the task is really just to notice when those things happen and think about, is there any value in shining a little spotlight on this, or inviting the client to either share in the humor or say why they don't think it's funny? I don't know much about the research, because I don't know that there's been a lot of research about ways to try to cultivate more of a sense of humor amongst therapists. I don't know about you. In my experience, many therapists already seem to have a sense of humor because they're dealing with a lot of stressful things on a daily basis. And at risk of sounding like I have favoritism towards the family therapy camp, I have found particularly family therapists have a good sense of humor. It's not research-based, but my intuition is that when you're dealing with so many different types of people who are intertwined in these dynamic ways and have assigned each other roles and sometimes get confused about whose feeling is this? Is this my feeling or is this dad's feeling or mom's feeling? I think you have to have a sense of humor to keep the dance of family therapy going. So I do find that people who lack this skill, it's anecdotal, but I think people who lack this skill tend to stay away from family therapy. But I certainly can't back that up with research.
That's how I discovered you in an article for Family Therapy Magazine, but you have this psychoanalytic training, which people think of as this very individual type of work. But yeah, it flows naturally into my next question. I was going to say, how do you think humor functions differently in a couple or family therapy than it would be in an individual treatment?
Yeah, there are some overlaps, of course, but then of course there are some distinctions. So I think with individuals, it really does hinge on the uniqueness of that one person and trying to understand not just their personality dynamics, but what do these symptoms say about their larger underlying struggles? What do they want to get out of therapy? All of those things. I think you can take a little more chances sometimes with the individual because it's easier to repair something on the fly. I think it's easier to say, you know what, that joke didn't land, but I apologize. Something caught my attention and that was funny to me, but let's move on. With the family session, there's so many different actors on the stage with different senses of humor. And of course, it's not always clear, even if someone laughs, do they really find that funny? Or is this the way that they navigate this kind of interaction in the system? Is that just a laugh to make my mother stop drawing attention to me? Or if the parents laugh, is it really anxiety and they're masking it as humor? It's so much more complex. But I don't think that should be a deterrent from using humor. If anything, that almost requires that there's more space for humor because, like I said earlier, on some level, what humor is noticing there's something incongruous about the way you've been seeing the world up until now. And now you have to deal with the fact that there's some new way of understanding or some new path forward or some new obstacle to deal with. And how are you going to deal with it? What makes the person finally laugh and say, oh, that's funny, is that there's been some resolution. And so I think if you think about humor that way, that is an invitation to think differently about things, maybe even derive some pleasure out of the discovery that you survived the uncomfortable situation. That's good stuff for family therapy. All the stuff, whether it's talking about how roles are assigned in the family, sometimes it's very funny. Someone will say, oh, this is our little man. He's the leader of the pack. And then you ask the little man, did you choose to be the leader or have you been appointed? And they're like, I don't want to be the leader. So there's always humorous interactions in the family dynamic. I think it's just, sometimes it's hard to discern.
If I'm assessing a couple or a family, even if they're coming in with some heavy concerns, if they can laugh together, not certainly make fun of, but make fun with their family, as I like to say it. In a strengths-based profession like MFT, I always think that is a strength that, as you said earlier, when you see it, even if you're not funny as a therapist, you should point out the humor as a strength between members of the system. So certainly I see this with couples. I work with a lot of couples and the rest of my population are teenagers and families. If a teenager and a parent, despite the midst of their tension and awkwardness, can joke and find humor, I find that is an incredible icebreaker, both in the room and again, a way to highlight a strength even among the constraints that our clients have. You also mentioned, in family therapy, we have some great characters and the battle of the brands in the golden age of the 70s and the 80s. These were showmen, Sal Mnuchin, people like Carl Whitaker. Now, some of the things they said in the way they thought about therapy have not aged well. Things like schizophrenogenic mother, some women bashing that led to, in our field, the feminist critique and a postmodern view. But we have very good examples of therapists being funny to build an alliance, to join. So you made me think there is something about a family therapist that lends more to being humorous. What are your thoughts, my friend, about helping clients find humor amidst even their most challenging or adverse circumstances? And I think many people come in demoralized. And as we say, our job is to help them remoralize. And sometimes humor can do that.
Yeah, I think just speaking for myself, it's aspirational. because I suppose I work from the assumption that, you know, life is both comic and tragic. It often seems more tragic when you're thinking about your own struggles and your own disposition. It's amazing how quickly it can seem comic when you're thinking about someone who lived 100 years in the past. Their reality was no less real than mine is, and yet it's hard to see beyond the horizon of your own immediate needs and struggles. So I do think that sometimes what we're trying to do in therapy, although it's not a goal we always can achieve, is help the person understand that life itself, to some extent, is absurd. And I don't mean that to be frivolous, and I don't mean that to be, I don't know, in some way dismissive of the real pain and struggles that people go through. But if you're paying attention, so many bizarre things happen just in the course of the average day. I look down to see if I drop something on the floor in my car. I almost get in a car accident. My heart's racing. And then all of a sudden I realize, okay, that's over. Now I got to go teach a class. I almost died. No big deal. Life is like that. And it doesn't seem funny in the moment, but later on that afternoon, you might catch yourself chuckling. Wow, I'm still here. Whatever anxiety I had about teaching class now pales in comparison. People are constantly being confronted with those kinds of contrasts between challenging things and then funny things. And if they can see that, they don't have to laugh. They don't have to have some deep insight. But if they can just understand that life is a dance between the absurd and the funny and the tragic, I think you've gone a long way towards helping them understand themselves, their role in their family, in society. People have been asking these questions since the dawn of time. Why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people? And we don't know. But I think being able to laugh at that and realize that you don't have control over those things really is a step in the direction of what we're trying to help people do in therapy. It's very serenity prayer-esque, but I think there's something to that.
Do you have any good stories yourself? And sometimes when you ask people to be funny, it's a paradoxical directive and makes them instantly not funny. But do you have any good examples in your own clinical work over the years of integrating humor that maybe both inspirational and aspirational for our listeners out there?
Yeah, I have an example of a time when I think it was effective, and I have an example of a time when it clearly was not. So maybe I can illustrate a blunder as well.
Please. Yeah,
I'll do the blunder first. A couple years back, I had been working with a client who was a part of the Jehovah's Witness community. And this person was telling me about a friend that they had met at work who identified as a Unitarian. And the client was explaining to me that she felt very conflicted because she liked this woman. It was nice to have this new connection. She even envied, I think, some of the, I don't know how you would describe it, spiritual elasticity that this person's belief system had as a Unitarian. And yet my client had been told her whole life, you have a obligation to proselytize, convert this person. And without thinking about it, and that was my blunder, I just blurted out this joke I knew. I said, what do you get when you cross a Jehovah's Witness with a Unitarian, a person who knocks on your door for no reason? And I thought that was funny, but I don't think the client understood the punchline. She certainly didn't seem to get anything out of it other than thinking I was maybe belittling her belief system. And I remember pinching myself thinking, the fact that a joke is funny is not sufficient for it to be used in therapy. Because essentially what I'm doing there is getting paid to amuse myself, which is not the goal we're aiming for. I thought a more constructive use of humor was, I was working with a college student who had come to see me. He was struggling socially and had expressed many times, as a lot of kind of anxious, depressed young men do, he was worried he wasn't doing therapy the right way. He wasn't the kind of patient I would have expected him to be. And I think it was his low self-esteem and lack of social experience that was causing him to think, I'm always going to mess things up. I'm not doing what Dr. Yusong wants. So one day before he came into my office, I turned all of the furniture in the office upside down. All of it. Tables, chairs, tissue boxes. And when he came in and asked what happened, I said, we're going to do therapy the wrong way today. And he looked very nervous, although he smiled a little bit. And he and I sat on our chairs upside down and we played catch with the tissue box. And we joked about some of the rules that he had invented for himself over the years about what he is and is not allowed to speak in his social group and all that sort of stuff. So the whole thing was upside down. And yet I had this sense that I had won him over that afternoon. I just started to notice that over time he was taking more social chances in his friend group. And he would come to session and report that he'd had his first beer at a college party, or he'd gone out on a first date shortly after that, dealing more in with his friends and joining activities and things like that. Then he had his first sexual hookup became an advocate for other students, all of these kinds of things. And while I'm not naive enough to think that my one joke about turning things upside down was the single factor that contributed to his success, I think in some ways it felt like it started with the idea that it's okay to be absurd. It's okay to make up the rules as you go. You can enjoy therapy instead of feeling like it's a litmus test. And that ultimately therapy should be a kind of practice space for exploring what any future interaction might be like. So that felt like a much more organic, successful use of humor. And we could share in it. That was humor where we were both enjoying the experience.
Yeah, I love those stories. We have a good amount of listeners that are either therapists in training or educators. So I think of what would this look like in a classroom. And I know you're an educator as well. So I don't know if you incorporate what we've been talking about today into their teaching. We all make blunders, therapeutic fails, as I say. It's developmentally normal in the life course of a therapist. Sometimes I have my students just talk about their greatest failures to each other in the therapy room. So it both normalizes the experience and it does usually produce some humor and light moments. I do that. And I also have, as I work with them on their authentic self, especially in their before they graduate, just use of self. And again, if you're naturally funny, it sometimes comes through in all their encounters. So if I've been watching their work or their peers have been watching their work, and if they're so buttoned up and stiff, it's clearly hurting the alliance. Getting feedback from your peers or your people in your supervision group of how to take what you naturally do outside of the therapy room or with your friends or members of your cohort into the therapy room, then doesn't become as much a stretch. So those are just a couple of the ways I do it. But I'm curious to your ideas about taking this into a teachable construct.
Yeah. Remind me of a very famous article that Jay Haley had published.
Wickedly funny and sarcastic Jay Haley, yes. But certainly also, as we've talked about today, the downside. Also, many people both loved, he was a very polarizing figure. They both loved him, but were also a group very offended by him as well. But he's certainly someone with a quick wit, a dry and sarcastic humor.
I think that is explained very well. In fact, that was my exact point, is I'm thinking of that article he published entitled something like How to Fail as a Therapist. So it's paradoxical in nature, but he's giving instructions to training therapists like make sure to only focus on early childhood events and ignore anything happening in the present. Make sure not to set therapy goals and just do things your way. And of course, on the face of it, it seems absurd. But the more you pay attention to these things, you realize how quickly and how easily it is to fall into that way of doing therapy, just droning on about what happened last week, how are things, and not really paying attention to the process. And of course, in that article, there are things that when I introduce that to some of my training, my student psychologists in their practicum classes, I'm X-ing things out with a Sharpie. No, I disagree with him about this, or I wouldn't word it that way. That would be offensive. So you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a give and a take with some of these things. But that is maybe an example of how I would introduce humor to my students, is understanding that you don't even have to find the humor in all of these kinds of prescriptions. But if you do the opposite of what you're trained here, you'll see how quickly it doesn't work. I also give them quotes sometimes. I'm thinking of, I have a couple written down here. The author, Martin Amis, said, "Humorless people don't just not know what's funny, they also don't know what's serious." And Oscar Wilde had said something similar. He says, "People are never so trivial as when they take themselves seriously." I think I'm trying to cultivate in my students an awareness that, yes, what we do can be incredibly serious. Someone might be thinking of taking their life, or someone might be reporting child abuse. There are times when the work we do is incredibly serious. And at the same time, it helps to have a buoyancy to what you're doing, an elasticity to how you absorb things clients tell you, or to notice when something absurd is happening. I suppose I wouldn't want to see a therapist myself if I didn't think they had that capacity. I don't know that you can cultivate that in everybody, but I certainly try as a professor.
You have said so many thought-provoking things this hour. I really appreciate it. As always, there will be some listeners who want to continue the dialogue. So Devin, tell us the best way to get a hold of you and to continue the dialogue. And if there's anything you would like to promote or any other resource that you think would be good for our listeners, please plug away.
Yeah, I don't have much to promote. It's one of the downsides of being a new father is even though your life is wonderful because you have a child around the house, all of your research endeavors and projects are put on hold. But listeners are more than welcome to reach out to me at my email address at Chestnut Hill College, where I teach. I'm more than glad to answer any questions you might have.
Your email is HUSSONG@chc.edu.
And in terms of recommendations, oh, that's such a long list. I wouldn't torture your listeners with this, but if you have an appetite for sometimes aggressive but very insightful comedy, check out George Carlin's work. Yeah, and I think that's it. That's one of the nice things about humor is it's such a diverse thing. It's hard to even give someone a recommendation. What people find humorous is so wildly different, but I think wherever you find it, cherish it. Make it a part of your everyday experience because it does enrich in your life if you can laugh.
Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast, where we relate, educate, innovate one episode at a time. This wraps the end of our sixth season. Little did I think that this venture would bring so much connection in my life, especially as we started before the pandemic and into the pandemic. It's really connected me to you, MFTs and systemic thinkers, really internationally, but also to colleagues and many that I had never met before this venture, and many I got to celebrate the good work and love of this great profession with on the show with you. So I'm happy to announce I still at least got one more in me. So we will be back for the seventh season, bringing you the latest and greatest in all things systemic therapy, both important topics and emerging trends that you need to know, and the really influential people behind the models and the drivers in the world of systemic couple and family therapy. A lot of times those guests, or especially those topics, are driven by you, the listener. Please feel free to drop me a line. I'm Eli@NorthstarCounselingCenter.com. You can always easily get a hold of me as well and see everything else I'm doing at EliKaram.com. That's EliKaram.com. There you will see the two projects I'm really proud of over the last couple years. My book with incoming president of the AAMFT, Dr. Adrian Blow of Michigan State. That's Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy for Rutledge. And this is a book that really ties the heart and soul of systemic therapy, what binds us together as relational healers, systemic thinkers, focusing on things like the therapeutic alliance, what helps a motivated client, how to give and receive feedback, how to tap into extra therapeutic factors like hope. And it's really helpful whether you're professionally young or you're seasoned, because it takes your way of working and you don't have to change that. It just gives you helpful strategies and exercises to build on your previously existing therapeutic skill set, stokes your curiosity for the work. And we really have gotten good feedback. And I also have a licensure exam book / model review textbook. It's called Marriage and Family Therapy National Exam, Your Study Guide for Success. And that's from Springer Academic Publishing. It also has an online digital component, including, and this is MFT studying for the national exam, really want as many practice questions as possible. So you get practice questions at the end of every chapter. You get a full-on practice test in the book and then an additional practice test in the online materials. And it's going to help you to quickly identify your areas of strength and weakness as you're preparing for the exam, and then also how to deal with test anxiety. And many people have that around an exam like this. So you can find out everything there. You can also see my on-demand online trainings if you do want to know more about this integrative and systemic common factors approach. And I also have an online training for the National Exam. Are you following us? Did you know that the AMFT is also active on your favorite social media channels? Be sure to follow us on the AMFT on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn, where you can catch all of the back editions from the last 6 years wherever you find your favorite podcast. I like Apple Podcasts and Spotify, but please go back and check out some of our greatest hits, not just this year, but over the last 6 years as well. I wish everybody a joyous and peaceful holiday season. We will be back in January. Until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.